edition of the Bomb Podcast. I am not Amin. I am Naima Cochran, better known as the senior pastor of Wednesday Service that is here on the Bomb feed. And I'm in conversation with Jerv and Trey tonight. We're talking about the premiere of ABC's The Soul of a Nation, which is a first of its kind programming event, 6 episodes of a series that is specifically about and by Black people in America. So this first episode was just the beginning, but I want to get you guys' thoughts. First of all, on the fact that this is the first time, like I had to go back and do some research. This is the first time there's been a news magazine series, right? Not just the two-part, you know, 2020 special or, you know, a PBS 3-part special, but like an entire 6-episode series that is specifically about Blackness in America. What do you think about that, first of all, that it's taken us till 2020 to have this?
Oh, it's ridiculous. But I mean, I'm not surprised at this point. You know, it's moving the goalposts, but this shouldn't be anything that really puts us up in arms or want to throw a party or something to be proud of. It's something that is embarrassing of this country and should have been changed a long time ago. But I mean, again, it's the same thing as having a first Black president or a madam, you know,
vice president
yeah. and what nation, like anything else that you kind of put in that scenario of a first. Why are we having first 60, 70 years out down the line when this stuff should have been, you know, out of the way? But, you know, again, very, very informative stuff. You know, we jumped in immediately with Harry Dunn and he gave his point of view of, you know, and his perspective of what was going on in the Capitol. And, you know, no matter if you're doing your job or not, you're still, you know, an N-word.
Yeah.
In America.
I think starting with Harry Dunn was crucial because for me, at least, January 6th, and I think the title is apt, although at some point, I think somebody, a narrator or whoever actually needs to say outright that the reason we're calling it The Soul of a Nation is because the soul of America is racism. And the reason we can't get past racism is because nobody wants to talk about the fact, nobody meaning white people, wants to talk about the fact that it is so embedded in the American consciousness, in the way America was built, in the ideas that our framers had, in the American economy, in everything about America, right? There is a bedrock of racism underneath it. So if we won't confront it, we can't get past it. And I think January 6th for a lot of us was that on display, like full out illustration, like the best possible example we could show anybody of this is how much white people feel like we are not part of this country. Like they are so, you know, they are so fiercely holding on to their ownership of this country that they are going to actually subvert the democracy because they're not getting their election results. So Jerv, what was your thought on Harry being the opener for this?
So I thought it was super dope having him open it up. It was timely. It just made sense. I'm one of those individuals that still has not fully processed how crazy that day was at the Capitol.
Insane. It was insane.
It's ridiculous.
As progressive as ours, insane.
It was embarrassing.
It was super embarrassing also, yes.
Super embarrassing, right? And like, whenever someone references it or whenever, especially when I saw him up there, it just brings it back. And then I go through that process again. It's just like, damn, I cannot believe that happened or whatever the case may be. I think it's super duper wild, but I'm not shocked that it's 2021 or, you know, when it was created in 2020, right? 2020?
No, 2021, because that was
January 2021. That was January 6th, bro.
My bad. Yeah,
time is flying, though.
But I think it's crazy. It's crazy that it's 2021 and we're getting, like Trey, like you said, like we're just getting the first of something of this nature or whatever the case may be. When I first heard it, I was like, oh, no, that can't be true because, you know, there had to be. And then you go through stuff in your mind. And it's like, well, nah, this actually is the first. So I think it was well done. I love that they started off with him. His story needs to be told, and it doesn't need to be told by you, myself, or anybody else. It needs to be told by him because he heard, he saw things that, you know, no one else would know actually happened, regardless of what you see or someone's Instagram page or anything.
Yeah. And I think it was important to note that, you know, he's saying, I got called a nigga, but basically defending the seat of the country, right? Literally defending the seat of democracy, defending the democratic process. And people are calling him a nigga for just doing his job in defense of our country. And I think that's so much of our story as Black people. You know, I've said before that I always find it interesting how the right, the extreme right, use our troops and our military service as kind of like code language. But I don't know a single person who is Black, who's been in America more than two generations, whose family's been here more than two generations, that doesn't have service people in their immediate family. Like, that's always been our story. And even if you want to go back to, you know, the post-war boom, the GI Bill, et cetera, like so much of what established white wealth now, or at least of a solid white middle class now with post-war efforts, we weren't able to take advantage of that, even though it was due to us. And I think that, you know, I want to use that to kind of jump into the other big topic of tonight, which was reparations. I think that Sterling Brown says something that I've always thought. Black people actually are probably the most patriotic people, because even though we get angry at this country, the reason we get angry is because we believe in the promise. Like, day by day, we move forward with the hope that the promise of America is somehow going to be, you know, it's somehow going to come to fruition for us. Like, we are probably the most invested in the promise of what America is compared to how America has actually treated us. So Evanston, Illinois is actually, you know, looking at a form of reparations in their town, because at this point, it's not just about slavery. It's even about that gap I was talking about in the mid-century between homeownership and redlining and wealth. And if you've never read Ta-Nehisi Coates' A Case for Reparations, please Google it. It is a very lengthy read. It is an outstanding read. Like, how he hasn't turned it into a full novel yet, I don't know, but it's perfect. And it's so eye-opening. But they are now finding a way to take money from revenue from legal marijuana sales, which is, this makes perfect sense to me, to apply towards a $25,000 payment towards every Black family in the town. And that's one of the biggest, I want to say maybe the biggest conversation of the night tonight was about that and how it can be a model for the country. So either one of you guys, what did you think of that?
Man, the promise, I mean, that's the same thing. I think it's been instilled in us from, you know, our elders in general, you know, from the stuff that they dealt with to seeing, you know, the growth in the country as far as, like, again, things that we're supposed to be throwing confetti for and said, oh, but look, we got the first Black president. I didn't never think I would live to see this. Or, oh, I didn't know we can drink out of the water fountain. Like, things that are supposed to be normal, these are the promise. And when you see these little tallies kind of stroke against the wall in the situation, you're like, ah, that's the promise. They keep, you know, see, if you keep living, things right. are going to continue to get better. And I think, and I think that's the Black hope, you know, going in that situation. And then you got some radical people that's just like, forget that. We're just going to take what we need and go about it that way. So again, I think it's kind of, you know, again, like you said, we're super patriotic and in a situation, although we have been, you know, done wrong in this country, you know, we still find a way to say we love this country. And, you know, for people to even be like, go back to Africa, like, right. that's a crazy term.
Like go back to Italy, motherfucker. Like, you know what I'm saying? It's just,
like if I go back to Africa, I'm like, bro, I don't know nothing about all here. What you telling me, bro?
Right. Jerv, what did you think or what do you think of, first of all, Evanston's, you know, attempt at their form of reparations? Because, I mean, let's be real. In terms of reparations, I think one of the biggest problems is that it's been so long, it's been hundreds of years, that to actually try to quantify an amount and determine who gets it is damn near impossible, which is why I think people don't even know where to start. It should have been addressed, like, earlier in the decade, the reason they were able to do it with the victims of Japanese internment camps, et cetera, is because they addressed it like within decades. Like there's a list, there's a finite number of people. Here's what we're gonna do. But Jeff, what did you think about that conversation?
So I'm glad you said that, because like my first thought was, wow, 25,000, that seemed kind of light, right? Yeah. But then, you know, I separated myself. I'm like, all right, you know, it would be any number that they say, like majority of people are going to be like, yo, that's light, or that doesn't make sense. They could say any number.
They could literally be like, we give each of you $1 million, and people like, that's whatever.
That's not enough. Right. But yeah. I think it's cool is probably not even right. I think it's a step in the right direction that there's at least some sort of number or amount or something that someone's come up with that says, hey, this is where we should start at. Right. So I like that. But it's kind of like what you said, our people have just always been hopeful. Right. The entire time, you know, whether it's your mom, your dad, your grandparents, your great grandparents, if you're blessed enough to have met them, you know what I'm saying? Like, we've all been hopeful. We've all bought into this dream. So part of me is like, that sounds cool, but I got to see it. Right. Like, I got to see the ball go in the hoop before I'm, you know, willing to be like, all right, it's a made bucket. Right. Like, I can't just lock in on it, because to me, it's just something that someone said, and until I see it actually happen or someone actually get it. So like she was saying, like, I'll be super duper hyped for the first person. Hell, like, I would love to pull up and celebrate with the first person that gets reparations, because at least that person becomes the symbol of, hey, this person got it. Stay the course. Everybody, everybody stay the course. We good. We going to get this.
And now we have a working model, right? Like, because I do think that's the biggest part of it, is that, like I said, I think expecting federations to come from like a federal level down to like every Black person at this point, I don't think it's possible, right? But if we start reparations from a conversation about home ownership and wealth building from like, you know, the 50s onwards, you know, and which is the approach that Evanston is kind of taking, looking at redlining and the blocking the past to home ownership and the wealth distribution. That is something that, you know, state by state, county by county, city by city, people can take a look at and actually do like a real tracing, because, you know, Illinois, major cities in Illinois, or cities with largely Black populations in Illinois, are still some of the highest segregated, you know, cities in the country, the same for Missouri, et cetera. So you can literally look at almost every major city and look at the line, like a dividing line between like the Black people and the white people. So I do think it's a smart starting point. I understand though people being doubtful, but I also think it was really interesting that the concept that it is, that reparations is the only legislative path we have towards any kind of, I guess, I don't want to say justice is too big a word, but any kind of restoration, you know, for the division of wealth and for the systematic like restraints that Black people have had on us. Do you guys agree with that?
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I'm with you.
I think that was interesting. I do want to close, because, you know, again, this is just one night of many. I want to say shout out to John Legend. I see you, John. Former client. I just want to close by saying one of the greatest questions asked tonight, and Trey, you brought this up too, and I was thinking about it. When was the first time you knew you were Black? And I think that's such a powerful question, because I'm hoping that white people are watching this, and I'm hoping they watch all six episodes. That's A, because this isn't for us, right? That's the first thing. The second thing is that one of the conversations I had often with white people last year in the wake of the uprising, and that I've had over time, honestly, especially when I get pulled into diversity conversations or conversations about how organizations or groups can better, you know, be inclusive, et cetera, is that Black people are consciousness of, Black folks are consciousness of our Blackness all the time, every waking moment. It is factored into every single thing we do. Every move we make, there is an awareness of what's the ratio in this room? You know, how am I going to come across? What's the perception? What level of the dial do I need to hit? Because we have at home us, we have in public us, and there's variations in between, right? So the like ally fatigue that people were facing this summer, you know, during the uprisings and the protests, we have a version of that fatigue just in our inherent living. Every day. And we talk about it all day, every day. I told somebody, every Black person, you know, has a group chat somewhere where they're talking about all the shit they couldn't say in the meeting, on that conference call. Like, we process this all day, every day. So, but that idea that there was a first time you realized you were different, that you realized you weren't the same, I think that's a really powerful concept. So, Jerv, I'll go to you first. Do you have that memory? Was there a first time you knew you were Black?
100%. I went to predominantly white schools all the way until I went to college. Mm-hmm. So I remember vividly, it was either first or second grade. I forget the exact year, but we were outside on the playground. And I'm probably one of four Black kids within my entire grade. Everyone's outside playing. No one has any issues with anybody. And I remember, I actually forget her last name. I would say her whole entire name if I could, but her name is Emily. We were playing, and I guess whatever game we were playing, it came down to some type of interaction between the two of us. Now, mind you, again, we're only in first or second grade. She literally turned to me and said, "My parents said I can't play with people that look like you."
Wow.
Now, mind you, again, we're outside at recess, right? It's probably the sunniest day, but in my mind, this story, it got super gloomy at this point. And I feel like a storm just came. Mm-hmm. I was lost. I had no idea what she was talking about. I remember coming home, talking to my parents, letting my parents know what happened. My mom is super, you know, my mom is born in Barbados. So she has this Caribbean kindness to her. She's like one of those individuals that if she won a ton of money, that if, you know, everyone says, "Oh, I'd get back to this and I'd do this." My mom would literally do that. My pop is from Philly. He spent some time in the D or whatever right. The case may be. So my pop pulled me to the side. Basically, yeah. Right? Like, he pulled me to the side. He hollered at me. And I just remember, I don't know if it was that moment, but I know for me, that moment was it for me. But for my dad, I feel like it was that moment where he realized, yo, like, I got to make sure I put him on to game. So, like, again, always going to these predominantly white schools. So I'm the kid when we learned about Christopher Columbus in school, right? And the teacher's telling us everything. I'm the kid that's raising his hand. But now my dad said that when he got back, you know, this, that, and the third, or, you know, all those type things. So, like, you know, I feel like that moment, me sharing that moment happening to me, made me realize what it was for me. It had some effects on me, and just how I functioned as a kid and how I acted in that school and the way I thought for a while, like ways that I'm even embarrassed to say that I thought, like, I thought that I was less, like, real talk. I thought I was less. I thought that me being light-skinned helped me. Right. I felt like true fact. I thought like I was just better because at least I wasn't as dark. Right.
Yeah.
And I mean, and then, you know, as I got older, obviously more aware, learn things and stuff like that, but not like, yeah, she said it to me. It was on the playground. I was hurt. And like, and
what's funny about that is that you just said you thought being light skin help you, is that one of the first thoughts I had was like, damn, she said that to you and you yellow. Like, that was one of the yellow. First thoughts I had. Yeah.
I used to use an orange crayon to color myself in school. Like,
so you was out here looking like one of Sesame Street characters.
Basically.
crazy.
What about you, Trey?
So I had two experiences. 93 during the riots. I was going into like the liquor store and I was getting followed around the store. Really wasn't understanding it because, I mean, I got money in my hand. It's evident, but, you know, I'm getting followed around as if I was going to steal from this liquor store. So, you know, I went home and I asked my grandma, like, why was this happening? And she was just like, you know, it's just how the world is. And, you know, some people are ignorant and that's what it is. And then of age, I think I was 15. I went to a camp and then, one of the coaches was like, you know, I'm going to take you to this banquet thing. And for the banquet, we were getting on the elevator and the lady clenched her purse.
Wow.
And I'm, you know, at this point, I'm 15 years old, but I'm kind of tall. And I don't think I look like a grown man yet. And in this situation, it was just like, why would you do that? Like, I don't want your purse. I have nothing to do with it. But, you know, those are the tough pills to swallow. And, you know, at 36 now, you know, I've had multiple occasions and just had to just accept the way the world is, you know, and kind of adapt and make the right decisions to keep myself out of trouble and survive to make it home.
My experience was kind of like Angela Rise, where she said, you know, there was so much of a representation of Blackness in her home. There was never a time that she wasn't aware. My family is a great migration family, Southern. Everybody, my grandparents' generation moved to New York after college. So my mom grew up here. My father was a military brat. My stepfather grew up here being in New York. All HBCU family. I was one of the first people in my immediate family actually to not go to a HBCU, and that was my boyfriend's fault at the time, not mine. But I don't know of a time when I wasn't aware of my Blackness, even though after nursery school, at the time we lived in Alabama, I went to nursery school on Tuskegee University's campus. But aside from that, like Russell Nursery, shout out to Russell Nursery. But aside from that, I also went to predominantly white schools like my entire career up to college at University of South Carolina. But there were two things. What I realized very early is that I was considered a different Black girl. Because of my hair, because of my intelligence, I was always in like advanced and honors, you know, classes. We're in the South. I didn't have an accent like that. Because everybody in my family was, you know, spent most of their time in the North. And I realized early, I didn't so much get that you have to be twice as good to go half as far conversation. It was more like you smarter than them. Know that. Right? That was the conversation. So I realized early that that code switching was a way to game the system. And I could use it to my advantage, right? So I use that exceptional, oh, they don't see me as the same kind of Black as they view those other people, to get away with a lot of shit, like shoplifting, like all kind, like whatever. I was like that. Nobody's paying attention to me the way they're gonna watch this other person over here. You know, on with professors, like all the way up through young adulthood. And what broke it for me was, and the first time I really realized what I was doing was I got pulled over in South Carolina. And I had like ponytail, glasses, like I had like a little Banana Republic blazer. Like I look like a very preppy Black girl, but there was a drug sweep in the county where my parents lived. And my mom's car was the same as like this drug dealer they were looking for. And I could not believe the aggressiveness with which the officer was handling me. Cause I was kind of like, do you see me? Do you hear my voice? You know, I really was shocked. And that's when I had to kind of snap out of it. Like, nah, you still a Black girl now, like, you know, but that was also the first time that I realized I expected to be, it was really, I guess, kind of a respectability thing. I realized I expected to be treated differently because I could flip a switch and carry myself a certain way, right? And that was a real reality check for me about my own behavior, not just about how I was aware that I was being treated differently. It was a reality check for me that I was taking advantage of it in that way. But even now, you know, there is still, sometimes I do still like to to show that, to pull the code switch just because it surprises people. And that's what is amazing to me is that white folks are really surprised when you know white shit. Like, we don't live in a country that's based on white shit. And I say this, note this to our white viewers and listeners out there. I'm just saying, it's the reality. The mainstream is the mainstream of everything. The default of everything in America is for, from the white perspective and for white consumption. So we have lived in this country or for however many years, and the majority of what we consume in media, the majority of what we hear on the radio, the majority of the news perspective, the majority of what we see, everything is based on whiteness. So the surprise when you know references for pop culture, mainstream, et cetera, and they're like, oh, you know that? Yeah, of course we know this song. This is what's on TV, dog. Like, why would I not know it? You know, this is what's in the movies. Why would I not know it? I take a little pleasure out of that shock moment sometimes. But we are going to wrap up on that question, unless Jerv, Trey, do you guys have any other thoughts?
Nah, I think you hit it on the nail. I mean, yeah. I'm looking forward to the next episode. This has been an interesting conversation. I'm very, very, very tuned in to where this goes and who they invite onto the show to get their opinions and their experiences. And I think it's very helpful for, you know, all Americans, all the world in general to tune in and learn and pretty much, you know, digest this, the lifestyles of what people are facing daily. You know what I mean? Not just during Black History or Buying Black or, you know, hopping on these cliche challenges or whatever it may be, but putting yourself in a friend, a neighbor, you know, a spouse, you know, a aunt, whatever it may be, in their shoes and understanding and trying to view it out their eyes, because it's two Americas, clearly.
There's two Americas.
And people will never experience it if, you know, because that's just how it is, you know, and it's unfortunate, but I'm looking forward to it.
As am I. Jerv, you have any last thoughts?
I'm you know, I just wanted to shout every person, whether it's known or not, who had a hand in this, all the people that were in the room when the idea was pitched, that probably may have got a couple eye rolls or whatever the case may be, but they pushed and they fought for it. So shout them out. And I'm super looking forward to, you know, next week and the following weeks to come.
So this is going to be on every Tuesday on ABC, 10 p.m. Eastern. Again, it's 6 weeks total. So we have a month and some change to go. I'm also interested in seeing what the other narratives are that they choose to examine over the next few weeks, because, you know, 2020 created an opportunity for us to have some frank conversations about race that many of us have been hoping to have for quite some time, but nobody was really willing to have below a very surface level. And even now, some of them are very surface, but I think this is an attempt to continue the dialogue in a real way, so to speak, but also to, again, invite other people to the Black perspective, because it, for us, it's more than just data points and statistics. It's great if you know about, you know, the gaps in incarceration rates and recidivism rates and, you know, what's going on in the family court system and, you know, police brutality, et cetera. But what do you actually know about Black life? And what do you actually know about the Black experience outside of just, you know, police brutality, economy, crime, et cetera? Like, what do you actually know about Blackness? Because more of us have been in your intimate family settings than you have in ours, right? So I'm hoping that this also goes into just like some general examination of the Black experience, period, aside from just those systematic barriers that have held us back. Because I think that's too often the public framing of our narrative. And there is more than that to our experience and our story. So on behalf of Count the Dings, on behalf of Bomb, we thank you for hanging out with us to talk about the first night of The Soul of a Nation. we hope that you'll continue to watch for the next 5 weeks. I'm sure we'll be touching on it on all the respective shows as it comes up. And a reminder that you can watch all of our programming and or listen wherever you find podcasts under Count the Dings and Bomb, or on YouTube under Count the Dings. And we will see y'all next time.